This is Mark Strassman, reporter with Utopia Media, and more specifically, reporter with Plug-in Hybrid Electric Vehicle World. We're about to speak to Greg Hansen, who's the VP at Energy CS. Welcome to Plug-in Hybrid Electric Vehicle World, or PHEV World.
Thank you.
I Googled you a few minutes ago, and apparently you've been involved with electric cars as far back as the ill-fated EV1. What was your involvement with that?
Yes, I leased an EV1 in July 4, 1997.
Right.
And at the time, I had my own small company doing professional audio electronics.
Right.
And but over the course of 3 or 4 years, the EV1 basically died, and I got more and more involved in the political process here in California to advocate electric vehicles and work with the State Air Resources Board on their ZEV program, ZEV requirements.
That would be zero emission vehicles.
The zero emission vehicle program. And I helped organize other EV drivers to be a voice for the technology, because in the past, when these regulations would come up, you'd hear from the oil companies and the auto companies saying that this is a bad idea, and you'd hear from the utility companies and the environmental saying this is a good idea. But you'd never hear from actual users because the technology hadn't really been out before.
Right.
So this was the first time that the actual EV drivers got a say in what was going on. We were driving the first vehicles out there, and we were loving them. So we said, you know, the automakers might tell you there's no demand for these cars, but that's not the full picture. I mean, there is demand for these cars. It's just that the awareness of the cars is so small, and, you know, it takes time for more and more people to learn about and become accustomed to the technology. So we need more time, because there certainly is a growing market for the vehicles, but unfortunately it wasn't fast enough for the automakers, and they were able to help collapse the program. Not so much through the regulatory process, but through legal means. They actually filed lawsuits against the state of California, and it got so bogged down in legal measures that eventually the state just changed the rules so that they pretty much got rid of the ZEV requirement. Although they still hold a glimmer of hope that eventually we'll have fuel cell cars down the line, but that's looking less and less likely every day now.
Okay, talk a little bit about the EV1 and why the roads are not full of EV1s now, and what you learned from your experience with the EV1 and how that informed what you're doing now.
Well, you're talking to a guy that owned a Betamax used a TRS-80 computer when he was young, and I have a knack for picking, you know, what might actually be good technology, but is not necessarily a winner in the marketplace. I have a replay TV, not a TiVo.
Right.
The EV1 was a product really ahead of its time, and like I said, General Motors and the state of California didn't give enough time for that market to really grow. The first year the EV1 was out, they actually didn't do a 1998 model year because they still had 97s on the lot that they couldn't move. Of course, we were all screaming and crying that they weren't doing any advertising and nobody had even heard of the car. But
and why did they refuse to sell any of them? They only would lease them.
So maybe they knew the program was not going to work and they wanted to be able to pull all the cars back at the end.
Okay.
Because that's what they did. At the end of the program, they basically said, okay, your lease is up, give us the car back, that's it. And so they took perfectly good cars off the road and, you know, either stuck them in storage or crushed them.
Okay,
so
well,
it's kind of sad that we were all forced, you know, most of us were forced to go back to gasoline cars. I was able to get one of the Toyota RAV4 electrics for the brief time that they were offered in 2002. But, I'm driving an electric RAV4 right now.
Okay, so now, as from a technical point of view, from a propulsion point of view, what was your evaluation of the EV1, and how did its experimental nature lead into what Toyota did a few years later with the Prius?
Well, quite amazingly, the EV1 was somewhat of an anomaly. I mean, being a quality vehicle from General Motors, the vehicle itself was really a technological marvel, and it's really sad how far GM has fallen since giving up on the technology. But Unfortunately, they didn't have very good batteries in the vehicle when it first started.
What kind of batteries were they?
They were actually made by Delphi. They were lead-acid batteries, but the consistency from battery to battery was not very good. And in a long series string of batteries, or fuel cells for that matter, you need very good consistency throughout the entire system. Otherwise, you know, it's kind of like the weak link in the chain, which is actually what our new company, Energy CS, specializes in. We do battery monitoring and technology for large packs of battery cells or fuel cells.
Can you say what you think went through Toyota's mind as they looked at the EV technically and as a marketing object, and what they did in the Prius to build on that or to diverge from it to create the hybrid?
So Prius, I believe, actually came from the Japanese efforts to counter the Partnership for a New Generation of Vehicles program that Al Gore was sponsoring in the 90s.
Right.
They were trying to get an 80-mile-per-gallon passenger car, and all the domestic automakers were working on diesel hybrids, for which I think, you know, only a few prototypes were ever built. So it really evolved out of that side, and as the Japanese showed the Americans that hybrid technology could actually work, that is, you know, Honda and Toyota,
right,
the state regulators said, well, hey, since we've got, you know, Nissan and Ford showing that, you know, we can build really clean gasoline cars, and Honda and Toyota, and we've got this hybrid technology that is not really ZEV, but it's kind of leaning in that direction. We're using batteries and motors and things like that that will be important for electric vehicles and fuel cell vehicles down the line. They said, why don't we restructure the program so that it's for clean gasoline cars and hybrid and other advanced technology cars more so than ZEV cars? Because what they found was it was a lot easier to get thousands of PZEV, that is partial zero emission, Ford Focuses or Toyota Camrys on the market than it was to get hundreds of battery electric cars on the market.
And so the benefits in pollution reduction would be comparable or greater?
Would be comparable, yeah. Instead of taking one gasoline car off the road completely,
right,
replace 10 gasoline cars with 10 really, really clean gasoline cars, and you get about the same emissions benefit.
Okay. Say something, if you could, about the launch of regenerative braking in the EV1 and how Toyota built on that with the Prius.
Well, a lot of this technology stems from the use of advanced electronics in the mid-90s to show that you could actually switch power back and forth with these new advanced circuits, these IGBT transistors, which allowed for intelligent motor systems that allowed for regenerative braking. And actually, that's what kind of opened the market for the EVs in the mid-90s was the AC motors and permanent magnet DC motors that, unlike the old DC motors, say, from, you know, the toys you might have had as a child, these motors could actually be, you know, more easily switched to be more efficient, more durable, and also have the ability of regenerative braking.
Now,
so all the EVs, all the modern EVs had regenerative braking, and this kind of started the idea for the hybrids. Well, actually, you know, you could say the hybrid idea has been around for a while, but the idea of recapturing braking energy and then using it somewhere else, whether it's in the main battery of a full functional electric or in a smaller battery in a hybrid that could then be used to help add power to the vehicle, thus requiring a smaller gasoline engine, a more efficient gasoline engine, you know, really lit the direction for this. And like I said, the American companies did have prototype hybrids out in the 90s. It's just that unlike Toyota and Honda, they weren't willing to take the chance to try and commercialize it. That is, up until Ford's recent Escape hybrid.
Could you clarify something for me and our listeners? In a hybrid, in the Prius, are the wheels driven by an electric engine all the time, or are they driven sometimes by an electric engine and sometimes by a gas engine, or does the gas engine feed its energy somehow, convert it into electricity into the batteries that then run it through the electric engine? How does that work?
The planetary gear set in the Toyota Prius and the Ford Escape is really an amazing technology. Imagine a black box with three inputs or outputs.
Okay.
You've got the gas engine on one side.
Right.
You've got an electric motor and the actual wheels of the vehicle on the other side.
Right.
And on the third side, you've got a generator. And the way it works, if the gasoline engine is not running, then you can run on the electric motor alone. Or if the gas engine is running, you can use the combination of the gas engine. You can use the gas engine to feed some mechanical energy directly to the wheels, and you can feed some mechanical energy from the engine over to the generator, which then generates electricity, which then powers the motor. Additionally, if you add some batteries, you can add the ability to recapture some braking energy, the regen braking, and then use additional energy from the batteries alongside the generator energy and the mechanical energy from the engine to drive the wheels.
So the wheels are driven both by the electric engine and the gas engine.
Correct. As a matter of fact, the gas engine, about 25% of the torque from the gas engine goes mechanically right to the wheels.
Right.
So most of the energy from the gas engine goes to a generator, which generates electricity to run the motor. And then the motor is run, like I said, from the generator electricity and from battery electricity if need be.
Okay, so it...
It's a fairly complicated system compared, say, to the Honda system, which is what people would call a mild hybrid,
right,
where the motor is built into the engine case and is basically magnets around the flywheel, which replaces the starter motor and replaces the alternator. It's actually such a brilliant and simple system that I'm surprised that every vehicle doesn't have something like that, akin to the Honda mild system. But the full hybrid system, as they call it, that's on the Toyota and the Ford vehicles, really is a leap forward because you can drive the vehicle on the electric motors alone if you want to.
Okay. So what's missing though in the Prius though is the ability to take on board more electric charge from an external source, as the EV did and only did. That was the only way the EV was powered.
Exactly. The Prius battery is really only designed to store enough energy, to recapture enough energy from braking that you might get from, like, decelerating off the freeway,
right,
or coming down a small hill,
right,
or something like that, and then to be able to use that stored energy to help you launch back onto the freeway or back from a stoplight or help you up a little hill or something like that. So it's really just a small amount of energy. It's kind of like a spring, you know, you compress it when you come to a stop, and then it helps you launch again.
Okay.
But it's not enough to, like you say, it's not big enough to be even worthy of being charged externally.
So in a real sense, what you've done, I'm sort of picturing a computer animation of this. You've essentially merged the capacity of the EV1 to take on extra charge and the ability of the Prius to run on gasoline or electricity, some of which is generated internally by the regenerative braking, and given one car, after you've dealt with it, which we're going to talk about, the ability to synergize to get the advantages of both of those models.
Exactly.
Okay, let's talk a little bit how you found your partners and the companies that you're working with now, essentially TechClean.com and Valence, that's responsible for the batteries. How did that happen? What? Tell us the founding myth and how you got together with these other companies.
Well, EnergyCS started in 2001, and it was a partnership between myself and my partner Pete Nortman, and another engineer from AeroVironment named David Swan.
AeroVironment, the people who make those solar-powered wings that fly in the
yes,
high...
the Helios and the Pathfinder.
Right, okay.
So Pete Nortman and David Swan both had extensive experience with electric vehicles.
And without getting too personal here, what was your day job before or during all this?
I had my own company, Zephyro Acoustics, that built digital audio equipment.
Okay. All right.
And by 2000, I was driving that company into the ground.
Right.
Because I was spending too much time playing with electric cars.
Okay. But you had good, you had good sound system in them, though, I suppose.
Yeah, of course. So the logical step for me with my engineering background and on my recent background with the electric vehicles was to join up with Pete Nortman and David Swan, who were leaving AeroVironment, to form this new company, Energy Control Systems, or EnergyCS, also in Monrovia, California.
Tell people where Monrovia, California is relative to things they may have heard about.
Monrovia is a little bit north of Los Angeles. It's a few miles east of Pasadena.
Okay.
And so David Swan is no longer with us. He's moved on. So EnergyCS is now Pete Nortman and myself, and we've got a small staff of a few other engineers and technicians in Monrovia.
As long as we're talking about companies here, is it privately held, publicly traded? Are you going to do anything about that?
It's a private company.
Okay.
The only public company that in this mix right now is Valence Technologies, the lithium battery manufacturer.
Right.
Valence Technologies builds a unique lithium-ion battery that's a very long life and very safe lithium technology relative to other lithium technologies out there, which can be highly flammable if the circumstances are, you know, not quite right.
So the Valence battery is distinguished by its safety and its the amount of power it can hold.
It's safety and long life.
And long life, yes.
Necessarily critical points for your laptop computer battery, but for a vehicle battery, they are essential. So
this is essentially the same technology that works in a laptop battery that you slide into the base of the laptop.
Yeah. Although the Valence technology, like I said, is a slightly different than the normal lithium technology. It's slightly less energy dense.
Right.
But it is more safe, and it is a longer lasting chemistry. So whereas your laptop battery might be designed to last only 3 years, in a vehicle we really need, you know, 6, 8, 10 years.
Right.
You know, to make something worthwhile.
Okay. And where does cleantech.com come into all this?
Now, cleantech is our third partner, Seth Seberg from cleantech, is a company in Los Angeles near LAX that does a variety of advanced technology vehicle conversions. They started off doing natural gas conversions of normal internal combustion vehicles.
Right.
And since then, they've been helping us with the Prius, not so much in a design way as more of a path towards commercialization. It's in the early stages here, the prototype has been done almost exclusively by EnergyCS. But we're partnering with CleanTech because CleanTech has the ability to be the sales, distribution, and manufacturing arm of eDrive Systems, the new company that is the fusion of EnergyCS and CleanTech. Because EnergyCS is really an R&D company. We do advanced battery and fuel cell systems, and companies will hire us to do prototype work for them. We're not really set up to be a manufacturer.
Right.
So it made sense to form this new company to be the manufacturer, and since CleanTech already has experience doing vehicle retrofits and, you know, interfacing with customers directly, it made made for a good union between the technical powers of EnergyCS and, you know, the front end consumer interface for CleanTech.
So, in fact, CleanTech plus EnergyCS created eDrive, and it's going to be an eDrive product that you're going to be selling using a Valence battery. Is that a fair way to put it?
The principles of CleanTech and EnergyCS are also the principles of eDrive.
Okay, and so eDrive combines the technical expertise that you've got and the manufacturing and installation capabilities that CleanTech does.
Exactly.
Okay. Let's say I've just bought a shiny new Prius, and I want to get it retrofitted by you guys. How long does it take, and how much does it cost to do this?
Well, at the moment, the conversions are on the order of about $2,000.
I'm sorry, we got dropped there. How much?
Of course, that's where the phone connector drops out, right?
Exactly right.
Right now, the conversions are costing at around $30,000, mainly because they're in the prototype stage right now.
Right.
Our goal is to commercialize the system so that early next year, I would say sometime, hopefully in the late first quarter next year, 2006, we'll be able to offer, through CleanTech, a conversion such that a person with a new Prius could be converted within a day for $10,000 to $12,000.
Okay. And how much does a new Prius cost today if you're not paying some bonus to get it sooner?
Depends on whether you get the full package with the navigation system and all the bells and whistles.
Well, let's say you do that.
Yeah, then probably out the door you're looking at around $30,000, maybe a $26,000 vehicle, you know, plus tax and license, you get out the door for around $30,000.
Can you say anything about whether Toyota is losing money on every one of those and they're subsidizing it, or are they making money at $26,000 to $30,000?
I believe Toyota is making money on the new Prius.
Okay.
There was, you know, from what I had heard from some of their statements in some of the Air Resources Board meetings, that the first generation United States vehicle, which is really the second generation Prius, because they had one in Japan
right.
prior to that,
right?
The first U.S. Prius was kind of a break-even product,
right?
Maybe a slight money loser, but more or less a break-even product. The new vehicle is actually a money maker for the company.
Okay, so all of the ones sold in the U.S. are the second generation?
Well, the new ones now, the 2004, 5, and 6 vehicles, are really a third generation vehicle.
Oh, okay. And how many...
The Japanese vehicle in 97 was Gen 1.
Right.
The U.S. vehicle in 2001 was Gen 2.
Right.
Gen 1 for the U.S. market.
Right.
And then the new one is technically third generation.
Okay. And do you know how many of those are on the road now? In other words, what your target market here is and how fast they're being produced and purchased?
I think, let's see. I'm not exactly sure. I believe there's somewhere around 150,000, maybe 200,000 on the road or soon to be on the road.
Of these second generation U.S., third generation altogether?
Yeah, the 2004 and 5 vehicles.
Right.
I think the vast majority of those are in California.
Right.
More so than any other place in the United States or any other place in the world.
So there are about 150 to 200,000 of those out there now.
I believe so. I'm not sure of that. I seem to recall hearing that they were on track to manufacture about 10,000 a month.
10,000 a month?
But I'm not sure of those numbers.
And do you know if the demand that's gotten so much media coverage is still as strong or stronger than it's been?
I believe the sales are just as strong as they have ever been. If anything, now that they are finally catching up with demand, individuals who may have been turned away by the long waiting list before, you know, can now actually go out and buy a vehicle at a dealership with, you know, very little wait time. So I believe their sales are just as high as ever. As a matter of fact, I remember seeing a chart recently of how all the different hybrid vehicles were selling, and the Toyota Prius outsells all of the other hybrid vehicles, you know, by a long shot. I mean, you know, you have the Honda Civic and the Accord and the Ford Escape, and, you know, the new Lexus and Highlanders have just come online. But, you know, none of them hold a candle to the Prius as far as the volume of sales. And Honda Insight, the little efficient Insight, which barely sells anything at all. It's almost a flat line.
So if we're talking about the Prius, we're pretty much talking about what the market is right now, and that's the one that you work with the most or sold.
Yeah, the largest market by far is the Toyota Prius.
Okay. Now,
and the Toyota Prius really made the most sense for us to do a conversion on because it was one of the most efficient vehicles out there.
Right.
I mean, if we could turn a hybrid 30-mile-per-gallon truck into a 60- or 70-mile-per-gallon truck, that's pretty impressive, but turning a 50-mile-per-gallon car into a 200-mile-per-gallon car or 150-mile-per-gallon car, that once you cross that, you know, three digits, you know, that
right.
people's eyes light up.
Okay, so, now briefly put, what were the technical challenges that you faced to implement this conversion?
Well, the first was to figure out how the Toyota Prius works.
Right.
And it was actually some of our experience working with Toyota, with Ovonic Systems in Detroit.
Right.
And Quantum here in Irvine, working on a hydrogen-powered version of the Prius.
Okay.
Both to highlight Quantum's advanced integration skills with hydrogen, and Ovonix was demonstrating their nickel metal hydride hydrogen storage system. And so they had a 2002 model Prius, old style, that had been converted to run on hydrogen.
When we say hydrogen, we're saying the same thing as fuel cell, aren't we? Or are we?
No. It's, same fuel as a fuel cell uses, but this is hydrogen to be run in an internal combustion engine.
I see, okay.
So as compared to a fuel cell stack.
So there are two ways to use hydrogen. You can combine hydrogen under pressure with oxygen under pressure and generate electricity. Or you can put the hydrogen in a hydride form and essentially burn it like gasoline in an internal combustion engine. Is that right?
The hydride storage is just a way to store the hydrogen.
Right.
As compared to, say, a high-pressure tank, which is how most of the fuel cell vehicles store their hydrogen.
And is that hydride stored hydrogen, is that useful either for a fuel cell or an internal combustion engine?
Yes. It's just a means of storing hydrogen. It's a more compact means of storing hydrogen. Think of it as a hydrogen sponge,
right?
As compared to compressing and putting in a scuba tank type situation.
Is the hydride sort of a powder or a liquid or what is it?
I should know that, but I don't.
Okay, it has less danger of being of exploding than hydrogen. Hydrogen under gas under or liquid hydrogen or hydrogen under pressure does, right?
Yes, it's safer in the hydride storage, I believe.
Okay. So
either way, hydrogen is a huge challenge because it's such a lightweight gas. It is the lightest gas, even possible.
Right.
It takes up a lot of space for the amount of energy it releases. I mean, it's got very little energy per volume.
Right.
So to store any useful amount on a vehicle, you have to either compress the heck out of it, fit it in a, advanced canister, or use something like the nickel metal hydride storage technology, but then you've got other cost and weight issues, so there's no perfect solution for storing hydrogen. But because fuel cell vehicles were, on the order of $1 million a piece at the time, it seemed easier to convert an existing vehicle to run on hydrogen using the internal combustion engine. And there are hydrogen internal combustion engine vehicles out there that various people have played with.
The advantages to them is that they're not polluting because they produce water as the byproduct.
A fuel cell produces water as the byproduct. An internal combustion engine would produce water as a byproduct, but also NOx, nitrogen oxides, because of the combustion process.
Oh, right, the nitrogen from the air, not from the fuel. Right.
Right.
It's a little off the tangent here, but how is it that hydrogen became the fuel of the future for a few years there, given what I have seen as a drastic need to build an entirely new infrastructure, in addition to the problems that you're just talking about here, and it's needed to be compressed to be at all useful and so on. What was it, more of a political than a technical breakthrough there to make it the fuel of the future for a while?
Well, it was a technical breakthrough in that the fuel cells, which had once been 1,000 times too expensive to be useful in a vehicle.
They were mainly used by NASA on the moon or in space.
Yeah, they're used on the space shuttle. I mean, it's nice because you can make electricity if you have stored hydrogen, which, of course, the space shuttle and the space missions do.
Right.
You can make electricity, and you can also make pure water.
Oh, okay.
So they had these systems that were, maybe 1,000 times too expensive to be used in a vehicle.
Right.
And then through a number of breakthroughs in the late 80s and early 90s, they were able to get 10 times reduction in cost of the fuel cells.
Down to $100,000.
Down to being only 100 times too expensive, yeah.
Right.
And they said, wow, we've made such great progress. If we keep going in this direction, then eventually we'll be able to use fuel cells in a car.
But it may be that they already had gotten all of the benefits they were going to be able to get.
That remains to be seen.
Okay.
But one of the biggest problems with fuel cells, whether you burn it in a gas engine or run it through a fuel cell and then, you know, run an electric motor,
right,
is that the hydrogen is so difficult to manufacture.
Right.
Aside from how difficult it is for, it's difficult to manufacture. Yes, it's the most abundant element in the universe, but it's not. It's something you can dig a hole in the ground and pull out of the ground like oil.
I thought all you had to do was run electricity through water and electrolyze it, and you'd have hydrogen.
That's true, but that's not how hydrogen is made today. It's made from natural gas.
Oh.
Because it's cheaper to make it from natural gas.
So it's essentially a refinery. It's like kerosene or rocket fuel or gasoline.
Well, it's used in refineries, actually, to clean up dirty oil.
Right.
But it's generated from natural gas because methane is basically carbon and hydrogen.
Right.
And so there's systems using steam reformation where they can pull the hydrogen out of water and a natural gas.
Right.
To make the hydrogen. But all the environmentalists say, well, that's not how we're going to make our hydrogen. We're going to make it from electrolysis, from
right.
water and energy. We're going to put up windmills and solar panels, and we're going to make all this hydrogen.
And what's the catch with that?
The catch with that is that it takes so much energy, so much electricity, to pull the hydrogen out of the oxygen, out of the water, to split water into hydrogen and oxygen.
It's an endothermic, energetic reaction.
Well, it's definitely, you know, it definitely takes a lot of energy to do it.
Right.
And then, of course, you lose more in the fuel cell, and you lose more if you're going to have to compress it to fit it in a vehicle tank. It turns out that it takes about 4 or 5 times as much electricity to make hydrogen to run in a hydrogen-powered car as it does to charge batteries to drive a battery-powered car.
All right, so I think we've come back full circle now, and that's why it's easier to just use the electricity.
Exactly. So if you've got, so you have a choice. If you want to run your car on hydrogen through wind power,
right,
versus running it on batteries through wind power, you're going to need about 4 times as many windmills
right.
to drive your hydrogen-powered car as you would your battery-powered car.
Sounds like one of these Total commercials, and how many bowls of Special K you need to get all your vitamins.
Yes.
So in fact, then, there isn't any reason why you can't get the electricity that you use in your adaptation of the Prius from solar photovoltaics or windmills or any other way of creating electricity, ranging from those to even to nuclear generated electricity. It's a lot more efficient to use the electricity itself.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Yes, it is. So the only way hydrogen makes sense is maybe in a Star Trek type future where energy is free.
Right.
So if someday electricity is free,
right,
then maybe we can waste, you know, 3/4 of it making hydrogen.
But in the meantime. If, for example, if cold fusion works out,
and
the energy is really, really too cheap to meter,
exactly,
and you want, but even then, it would seem to me a waste if you can get the same propulsion from 20% as much electricity to go through all the trouble and have to build the infrastructure and so on. If you can get, especially if you can get the electricity from natural sources,
you know, batteries, which are getting less and less expensive every year,
right?
If batteries for some reason were too expensive,
right,
and fuel cells came down to be pennies,
right,
which seems unlikely,
right,
then you could argue that, well, maybe it's worth,
okay,
you know, taking the energy hit. Plus, hydrogen can be refueled very quickly.
Right.
Hydrogen is like gasoline in the sense that you can refuel a car in a few minutes, whereas batteries take a while to charge.
Okay, I got that.
Which is how we get back to the plug-in hybrid.
Exactly.
But I'm going to have to cut you off here because I'm about to go in and grab some dinner.
I know. I was about to say that myself. Could we just sort of wrap up now and we'll pick up again as soon as we can?
Yeah, that's fine.
And we can talk some more. So let me thank you for talking to us today.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
And we'll be back in touch pretty soon.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot.
All right.
Bye.
Bye-bye.